Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 12th of Tammuz. Today, actually, we're going to do two responsa written on the 12th of Tammuz, and that allows me to pause for a second and point out that there is some level of choices that I have to make in terms of finding responsa. Usually, when I open up my Bar Ilan and I look for responsa connected to a certain day, I get about 50 choices, and some of them are Meshivim who I don't have a relationship with, and therefore don't spark my interest. There are plenty of others who I do, and then I have to find a tshuva that's both of the right length, because it has to be something I can present within the amount of time that I've chosen, the half hour that we have together, and it also be something, usually I try to find something that's not too technical, because I often cannot explain the technicalities and make it clear and interesting within the amount of time that I have, so I'll shift to something else. Some days, I don't find anything that really appeals to me on along the axes of which I've chosen, or at least one of them, and therefore I'll put together two that are, or a few, that are much shorter, but that I can cover in the amount of time. So today is one of the examples of those days. Other days, for example, I often find interesting, every so often I'll find that, you know, a certain respondent, a certain meshiv, let's say Rav Moshe Feinstein, had four short tshuvot on a certain day, and then it's sort of like a brief history of his life, of his Torah life on that day, as far as we have it, in his tshuvot. So I sometimes find that interesting too. Today, I happen to have found tshuvot written about 100 years apart, by Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, who was one of the premier meshivim of the mid to late 19th century, and another one by Tzitz Eliezer on related topics of how we deal with either non-religious Jews or even anti-religious Jews. And so we'll see those two tshuvot for today. So the first by Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector is published in Shut Rav Yitzchok Elchanan in Siman Ayin Aleph in responsible number 71. And this was written on the 12th of Tammuz, Tof Resh Mem Vav, which was 1886, from Kovna. Interestingly, it's written to Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. So Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer is an important Rav in Germany at the time. And Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer published this tshuva in his shoot as well. Shoot Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, Chedek Aleph, Orach Chaim Hei. I think the shoot Rabbi Israel Chana wasn't published until much, much later. So it could be that Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer was publishing it, nobody else had yet. Or also it's possible that Sfarim didn't travel so far. So if Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer has a valuable and interesting tshuva from the Rav Yitzchok Elchanan, and it's either not published or it's only published out in Kovna in some place where the Sfarim weren't traveling so much, it was worth his while to publish it. In any case, we have this tshuva from the 12th of Tammuz of 1886. In the beginning of the tshuva, there's an interesting piece of it that has nothing to do with the halacha question, but Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector thanks Rav Yisrael Hildesheimer, who had apparently intervened on behalf of Rav Yitzchok Elchanan's brother, who was going to be evicted from an apartment or thrown out of an apartment. And Rav Yitzchok Elchanan thanks him for having helped work it out, that now he's being able to stay in the apartment, and it's been so helpful to him, and he's been so excited about it, and it's sort of a human moment within the tshuvot, and he prays that Hashem should, that this merit should protect them for a long time, and he's so happy, etc. It's a reminder first that rabbinic families aren't immune to problems, that he has his brother who apparently was going to have a problem with staying in his apartment, and that they help each other and they found ways to help each other. That's just a human interest moment for a response of a day. The real question was that Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer wanted Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan's view of whether to give aliyot to, or whether to allow sort of to participate in shul in terms of getting an aliyah, in terms of counting for a minyan, in terms of giving them a bar mitzvah, people who did not have a brit milah, who did not have a circumcision. So we'll do a Yitzchok Elchanan's answer, and then we'll think about it a very little bit, even though I don't question these tshuvot, but just think about it a little bit. Yitzchok Elchanan points out that al pidin, according to halacha, a mumar la'arelut, if a person has not had an oral circumcision, that does not make them a mumar l'chol haTorah. In halacha, there are several categories of mumar, of people who have rejected part of all of the religion. One who rejects all of the religion has all of these statuses that were named in the question. You're not supposed to count them for a minyan. You're not supposed to You can't rely on their shechita. If they slaughter an animal, you can't rely on their shechita. There's all sorts of issues that come up with people who have rejected the entirety of Torah. The question is, what are the various levels? So usually, if somebody stops observing one mitzvah, whatever that mitzvah may be, with the exception of Shmirat Shabbat, with the exception of observing Shabbat and of idolatry, but usually one mitzvah doesn't count as a rejection of the whole Torah. However, and Rav Yitzchak Kahn does not get into this, so I'm not going to do it now either. If somebody does it lahachis, if somebody does it in terms of a rebellion against the mitzvah, in terms of saying that I don't care about this mitzvah, I object to this mitzvah, or something along those lines, that has a more complicated status. In any case, Rav Yitzchak Kahn says, and this is accurate, if somebody simply doesn't circumcise, the assumption here would be that they don't circumcise lite avon, they don't circumcise because it's painful, they don't like it, it's unenjoyable, right? Those kinds of reasons. If it's done as a rebellion against the Torah and against mitzvot, that would be a harder question, but Yitzchak Kahn does not raise that issue, which is itself interesting, it seems to me, because the people in Germany about whom Rav Yisrael Heldesheimer are talking weren't just not having it because they preferred not to have it, they weren't having it because they had decided that Judaism didn't apply in that way anymore, that it wasn't really part of Judaism anymore. It's a whole other conversation. In any case, he points out, A, factually, the rejection of arelut, of circumcision as a mitzvah, the rejection of it in terms of the Te'avon at least, does not count as rejection of all of Torah. And then, at any point, then he gives sources for that. And then he says, also, we have a principle in Shulchan Aruch that until somebody has been put into excommunication, they put into nidui, they count for a minyan. And therefore, since these people are not being put into nidui, it's unclear to me how Yitzchak Kahn is sure of that. That's an interesting question of its own about the politics of the time, whether or not the organized, what we would call Orthodox movement of the time, how they did or didn't react to the reform in terms of nidui and things like that. But to the extent that this person has not been put into nidui, has not been sort of excommunicated and let know that the community objects to his behavior, you still count them as part of a minyan. So therefore, Yitzchak Kahn's assumption is, we should not distance ourselves from such people. We should worry that if we do distance those, as we say, you can't get an aliyah, you can't be part of shul, you can't be part of a minyan, then we have to worry that they will get worse. They'll get even more distance from Judaism, and they might leave the religion completely, they might leave the nation completely. So even though now, he says, they already are doing that themselves, right? They're the ones who are distancing themselves by changing into another denomination, by refusing to be part of Brit Milah, which is a thing that usually unites all Jews. Nonetheless, we should worry that they'll go worse, and not only that they'll go worse, meaning they'll leave the religion even more so, which is a problem, a challenge of its own. He says, we also have to worry that maybe that it will inspire such hatred in them that they will then turn into antagonists and they will cause problems for Jews and they might become, God forbid, rotfim. They might become those who try to really persecute us in various ways, as has happened in Jewish history. As we've seen, as he says, we've seen in our times, in his times. And therefore, he thinks that he shouldn't distance them completely. And maybe from the welcoming of them, they will find it in their hearts to do tshuva, to repent, and to come closer little by little until maybe they return completely to the service of God. As support for his claim, he points to a taz in Yoredeya. The background is, here in Yoredeya, in Shin Lamed Daled in 334, the Shulchan Aruch is talking about people who are going to be put into nidui. Nidui was a lower form of excommunication. It was when a rabbinic authority pointed out to somebody that their behavior was inappropriate in some way, in important ways, and that they needed to reflect and change and to apply some communal discipline to that by a partial shunning of that person. So the Shulchan Aruch says if somebody transgresses the Torah, ha'over al devar isur, they violate halacha. And the assumption is they violate halacha not unwittingly, they just said they want to. Minadin oto le'alter. You put them in nidui, meaning there was a time. This obviously wasn't true anymore in Yitzchak Kahn's time. It's certainly not true in our time. But there was a time when the expectation was that if a rabbinic figure saw somebody violating the Torah on purpose, and you know that's a violation of the Torah and the person didn't really care about it that much, they would put them into nidui. They would say, you are now in nidui, and they had to react in that way. Nidui lasted for 30 days at least. And the Ramah, this is going to be what the Taz is going to react to. The Ramah there says, Uminadin lechayev nidui. When somebody is obligated for nidui, is liable for nidui, they've done something that deserves nidui. The Rambam has a whole list of things that deserve nidui. If somebody does any one of them, you put them in nidui. We do this shunning of them. Va'afilu yesh lachush shal yedei chen yetilat ra'ah. Even if you think and you say to me, maybe this will have a negative effect on them, they'll go the other direction. Meaning, the point of discipline is to let somebody realize they've done something wrong and have them hopefully regret that, reflect upon it, and therefore improve. But sometimes, unfortunately, people take that discipline and they use it as the reason that they will go even more in the other direction. So the Rama says, we don't worry about that. You put the person in the duty anyway. Long Taz there, commenting on that, says, I find that very surprising. How could it be that we're going to be so worried about this one prohibition the person violated? That's the cause of the Nidui. The cause of the Nidui was to show them they've done wrong by violating the Torah in some way, by violating Halacha in some way. We put them in Nidui. So the Taz says, we're so worried about this one thing they did wrong. Now, let's remember, the Taz is writing in the 1600s, maybe early 1700s. So this is a time before even the emancipation, this and this, and yet the Taz is going to write about the fact that there are rebellious people out there. So we sometimes think that our modern problems are completely different and completely new, and then you find a Taz like this, which is going to be reflecting on issues that perhaps are more prevalent today, but were prevalent enough in his time that he was already aware of it and concerned about it. So the Taz says, we're worried about this one Isser, and then we're going to cause him to, God forbid, go l'tabud ra'ah, which will mean that he'll violate many, many other Isserim. And the Taz uses a phrase that has become a little well-known today because somebody who unfortunately went that way used a similar phrase as the title of his book, Asher kol ba'eha lo yishuvun, all who go shall not return. So the Taz uses that phrase about people who go to Tabut Ra'ah and saying that we don't want to get into that situation. That would be an awful situation. Then he says the Rama got his psak from a Truma Sadeshin, and the Truma Sadeshin said it was about when that there's a case in the Gemara, the Rav Acha Bar Yoshia put into Nidui people who violated Shabbos, and he used that as proof that even though it would seem that a Nidui would lead people to continue on their path or do even worse, that doesn't affect us. So the Taz says that story isn't quite, he thinks it's not necessarily a proof for various reasons that we don't have to get into right now. But then he says, and I have a proof the other way, because the Gemara talks about the fact that, and this is a Rashi and Chumash as well, so for those of us who don't know all the Gemaras, but maybe we can know Rashi and Chumash, as Rabbi Mordechai Willig once said to me many, many, many years ago, that we should know Rashi and Chumash. At least the Gemara in Kiddushin says, let's say somebody sells themselves to an idolatry, to some kind of an Avodah Zarah, right? And the Torah says we have to try to find a way to redeem that person. And we have a Tana de Beir Rabbi Shmuel that says there, this person has become like a functionary. A komer is really like a priest or a bishop, but a functionary of an Avodah Kochavim. Maybe I should say, push the stone after, meaning maybe we don't care about people like that. If he has sunk so low as to be willing to sell himself to serve the Avodah Zarah, serve the Avodah Zarah means like sweep the floors or be a janitor or whatever it is, but the point is they've sold themselves into slavery to that thing and therefore they've joined that world, maybe we would have said, let's abandon him, right? That we won't try to redeem him. The pasuk says, gulati elo, we have to make sure to redeem that person. The Taz says that shows right there. The Gemara looks at this person as if they're already actively involved in Avodah Zarah, and yet we have to help them come back. So the Taz says, all the more so for this person who has violated something, but we're supposed to try to help them come back, not just pushing them away. So that's the Taz thinks of as a proof. Especially if what we're going to do is refrain from putting them into a nidui that we think they deserve, refrain from shunning them in a way that we deserve. Taz has other proofs as well, but our point is the Titliezer, the Ritzuk Lechanan, not the Taz. But that's the thrust of the Taz's claim. Later on in that same siman, he quotes the Maharam, who says that nowadays, if the Taz living in the 1600s, the Maharam lived in the earlier than that, when Hanidui and Mikul Kalim, right, when Nidui doesn't work as well as it used to, we don't really put into Nidui all those who deserve Nidui, even for serious sins, even if it was Shura Sadin, even if the Halacha is really that they deserve the Nidui, we're not so stringent about that because we're worried that it might stop the person from doing tshuva, from repenting, all the more so Then Rataz says, the Maharam says, all the more so, the Ramatz, who was quoted in the Maharam, says, in their generation, meaning various generations are at play here, where everybody's agreeing that there are people who, if you try to discipline them, they will respond exactly the wrong way, and they might respond to you publicly about it, and they might do terrible things, and it might lead, in one of the cases, one of the sources says, might lead to murder. And therefore, you have this line of people, not just in the 1800s, when the Enlightenment was there and there were rampant lack of observance. You have a line of people throughout the 12, 13, 14, 15, 1600s who are saying, if we apply the Talmudic versions of discipline, the results might be worse that rather than better. And the points of the discipline will try to help people become better, and therefore you can't do it. The Ramah didn't seem to think so. The Ramah seems to say, if there's a halacha that you do need to do it, you do need to do it, and you don't worry about those situations. These are complicated questions. These are issues that deserve a lot of thinking. The Taz is thinking that doesn't make any sense. It's not for me to say, but I will wonder about, if the Taz is talking about a particular single individual and we let that go for the reason the Taz says, that's one thing. But then what happens when the whole generation goes in that way, and then there's a breakdown of this kind of discipline in general, that becomes more of an issue. That's more the issue that Rizal Khan was thinking about, although let's remember that Rizal Khanan is not quite dealing with it in the same way as as Rizal Hildesheimer is dealing with it. But this is his perspective, because if you look now back in the Shut Rizal Khanan, he says he thinks the Ramah would agree, even the Ramah would agree in their situation, because the Ramah said it in a situation where there's a halacha to put somebody in nidui for a certain reason, there's an obligation to. So where there's a halachic obligation to put somebody in nidui, the Ramah says you got to do it, you got to follow the halacha, because that's the halacha, and therefore you can't worry about the consequences. But in the Brit Milah situation, the person who's refused to have a circumcision, right, where the halacha seems to be that they're mitzaref la'asara, that they can be included in 10 because they've never been put into nidui, and they've never, right, so that's already question, right? They are in some public sense refusing to have a circumcision. That usually would be somebody who would be put into nidui, but they have not been put into nidui because of the way the 19th century jury is working. But because they haven't put into nidui, Rabbi Yitzchak Kahn says, you can and should count them for a minyan, and therefore we shouldn't make up new versions of discipline. Ubifrat, he says, especially since we have to worry that they are going to be yotzei l'tarbut ra'ah, they're going to, if we apply any discipline, get worse and do worse than that, they'll separate themselves from the Jewish people completely. Therefore, he thinks that they should just follow the halakha, which is they can be called up to the Torah, and they can be included in the minyan, and all those kinds of things. And he says, I have more to write about it, but I'm ill, and he doesn't have svarim, and the doctors told him he has eye problems, the doctor told him that he can't be looking at svarim, and therefore, this is his view. But he trusts Rabbi Zvila Hildesheimer's judgment, and he should do what he thinks is right. Okay, that's the tshuva from the 12th of Tammuz in 1886. Over 100 years later, Tzitz Eliezer in volume 20, Siman Mem Vav, responsum number 46 on the 12th of Tammuz of Tufshin Nun Gimel 5753, which is 1993. So he writes back to somebody who sent him a sefer to give a haskama. He writes a haskama on the sefer. It's called the Bayit HaYehudi. It's the eighth volume of it, and it's about mitzvot HaTliot Ba'aretz. It's about the mitzvot that have to do with the land of Israel. And L'chibat HaKodesh, in his love of what's sanctity, what's holy and what's good, he's going to make two comments on the book, things that were left out, and he thinks that can supplement the discussion in the book. One issue was, the book had discussed when there's Truman Maser being given in Israel, right, there are fields that are growing produce, and they have to give Trumot and Maser, they have to tithe it in the appropriate ways. So he talks about who is capable, who is halachically valid for separating Trumot and Maser. Tzitz Eliezer adds that sometimes you have a situation where the people who are overseeing it, the mashkichim, right, the rabbinic supervisors who are seeing that the Truma and Maaser have been taken properly, sometimes they say they want to get the owner of the field to do it, right? And it's like an honor them with it, and they want to make them part of the process. And I assume that what they were thinking is, and they'll be involved in it, even though many of them aren't observant, from the experience of it, they'll get a sense of the religion, they'll get a sense of closeness, it'll be a friendly thing. We're helping them make all of their produce kosher and available for people to use. And all those kinds of things. Tzitz Eliezer says, sometimes some of those people are mumarim lechachis. So that's a category Ritz Chochana didn't think about, didn't discuss, not because he didn't know about it, he just didn't discuss it. Meaning, my impression from Ritz Chochana's tshuva, from his response to him, is let's think of these people as just having not happening not to have done a Brit Milah and preferring not to do a Brit Milah because it pains them, because it's uncomfortable, for all the various reasons that would qualify as Lite Avon. And when somebody violates the Torah Lite Avon, even a relatively serious obligation like circumcision, that's a category. So that Ruth Holland doesn't consider the possibility that there might be Mumarim Lahachis. By 1993, when the is writing this, he's saying that some of these people qualify as Mumarim Lahachis. So Mumarim Lahachis is somebody who violates any piece of the Torah, but they do it on purpose. An example that I've seen quoted many times is that if somebody has available kosher food and chooses to eat non-kosher food, and that's a complicated one because I could have imagined saying that that was Lite Avon, that that was a matter of appetite, because let's say they just know that, or they think that, you know, non-kosher steak that has been cooked with butter on it tastes better. So even though there's a kosher steak in front of them, they choose the non-kosher. That's nonetheless in traditional sources. How we do that, deal with that today, I'm not getting into. But traditional sources, that's an example of a moral hakis. And the other example that he gives is mechallelim Shabbos befarhesya. They are people who violate the Shabbos in public. I would note that today, I think there are many people who assume that we can treat such people not as mumarim lahakis, as being purposely in violation of the Torah, that we can today treat them as tinokot sheneshbu, meaning even though they grew up, since they grew up in non-observant homes, and even the ones I've heard people say, even for those who've grown up in observant homes, since the times are so opposed to observance, that we can treat them as tinokot sheneshbu, and that would mean that their violations of the Torah do not count to make them part of these categories of a mumar lahachis, of somebody who on purpose is violating the Torah out of a sense of rebellion, out of a sense of disregard for Torah and Halacha, or that they violate Shabbos in public, that they don't count as purposeful violations. Tzitz Eliezer does not bring any of that up. He says because he thinks that that would mean that there's room to say that they cannot, and by cannot he means they technically cannot give truma. That even if they try to separate the truma, it doesn't work because they're not part of the Torah fabric anymore, so much so that they cannot be part of this. And he says, and he thinks the Chasam Sofer several times in his Tshuvot said something along those lines. And that would mean, therefore, that the Mashgichim in this situation should not, so there's a Chasam Sofer, had noticed, he built off of Magid Avram, that Trumat Mumar is not Truma. That if you have a Mumar, that his Truma doesn't count as Truma. So this is already a very a technical halachic question, right? There's the broader, you know, we might call it a kiruv question, an outreach question of how we treat such people. Tzitz Eliezer is saying he thinks he has a technical issue with whether or not these people can validly give truma anymore. It's one thing to say, as Yitzchok Kolan did, said, they can get an aliyah l'Torah, they can be called up to the Torah, they can come as part of a minyan. He's saying, I don't think that such people, and they're not exactly the same categories, but I don't think such people, if they were to give truma, I don't think it's valid truma, and therefore the mashgiach, the supervisor, would have to make sure to be the one who gives the truma. The second comment he makes has to do with, he says, mitzuyim ba'aretz harbe karaim leminehem lemoshvotehem sheish lem sadotu kramim. There are many. Now the word karaim means karaites. So karaites, I think there are karaites in Israel today, as it happens. There are, in fact, I checked online, there are about, there are estimated about 35,000 to 40,000 Karaites in Israel today. So that could be what he means. But he also says, Leminehem Lemoshvotehem, there are all sorts of Karaites. And they have fields, and they have orchards, and people buy their fruits, and they come into contact with them. So the question is, do they count as Jews or non-Jews in terms of Trumot Matzot? Meaning, if a non-Jew grows, if a non-Jew owns a piece of land, and he grows a piece of land, that's a whole question that relates to the Heter Mechira, to the selling of Israel in Shemitah. But if a non-Jew owns land and grows the land, and then he processes it to Meruah, to the final processes of the harvesting process, so then we think that it's not chayav, it's not obligated in Trumot Umasrot, it's not obligated in Truman Meiser. So the question is, does their stuff need it, these Karaites? So he found a book called Pri Haaretz by Rav Mizrahi, who was it's an old book, and he had said that for all that many people treat the Karaites as non-Jews for all sorts of purposes, they would agree, he claimed, they would agree that that you would have to do it in terms of Truma Masa, you would have to take Truma Masa just in case. And then he says, but maybe you would have to do it without a bracha because we're not completely sure, and especially because Truma Masa, according to most opinions today, is a Durabana. Right, so it's a rabbinic obligation. It's not until you have the majority of the Jewish people living in Israel, which is not as far as it used to be. I think by now, I'm pretty sure that the statistics are now that the largest percentage, the largest group of Jews in the world now lives in Israel, which is a remarkable thing if you think about how long ago it was that Israel was a tiny Jewish community, 120 years ago for sure, tiny Jewish community, and now it's got the largest plurality of Jews. I think it's something like 43% of Jews now live in Israel, and 41% live in the United States of America, and then there are tiny groups elsewhere. So it's not as far away as it once seemed, that it's visible on the horizon. In any case, now that it's Drabanan, he says, therefore, one should do it without a bracha. And he also finishes, and it's also, he finished by saying, Machmir le'aser, if somebody is machmir to give maser, so alav tavo birchatov, he should get blessings. So it sounds like that's true, that he means it as a chumrah, that we're not for sure of it. Then he says, or Tzitz Eliezer says, based on that, that would be a Shemitah question as well. Does Shemitah apply to their fields? Since according to most poskim, Shemitah is Dirabbanan today, as this Rav Mizrahi had said, there's room to say it either way. So let's say somebody didn't want to go with the Heter Mechira. So when it came to the Karaites, there's a whole new question. Maybe they count as non-Jews, and therefore maybe we can just buy from them, because if they own it and they work it and they produce it, maybe Shemitah doesn't apply. So there too, Tzitz Eliezer thinks that we should be machmir. If somebody's machmir, that would be even better, not to treat them as non-Jews for those purposes. And then he, as a postscript, he points out, this is not a non-Jew or Jewish question, he points out the Chazon Ish in general, he agrees, points out in general, we shouldn't be as confident as we are, as we think we are sometimes, about the borders of Eretz Israel and about place names of Eretz Israel, because it's not clear that those place names are exactly as they were before, and therefore the borders might be different. So if there are places where the Gemara says, well, this is outside of Eretz Israel, and we find a place named that today, Chazon Ish says we can't be too quick to be sure that that place is the same place, because over the course of time, places have been destroyed and rebuilt, they've been moved, they've been changed, and therefore we can't always know about it. That's a broad point to think about in lots of places in Eretz Israel, not things like most of Yerushalayim, but in other places where you have the name and you think, oh, I'm in the place where this used to happen or that used to happen. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but the Chazon Ish says we have to be careful about it. So our broad point for the 12th of Tammuz was the question of how we deal with, sadly, those who are not observant. We pointed out Rizkel Chanan Spector's overall perspective was that we have to follow the halachic categories in these situations, but there are many situations where people violate things that seem offensive and seem problematic to us, but when we look carefully at the halacha doesn't say that we're required to shun them fully, and his example was even something that would seem so distant from Judaism, like not having a brit milah, not having a circumcision. The Chochanan felt that one could treat that as a single violation of its own that doesn't require shunning in terms of excluding them from a minyan, excluding them from shul, excluding them from getting an aliyah Torah, from being called up to the Torah, and especially since he follows the view of the Taz, which is one of the views from within all of Jewish history, that you don't want to risk sending people further away. You always have to take that account. So the Taz example was to put somebody in nidui, to shun them, if that's going to make it worse, that's something we shouldn't do. There was the other perspective, and then the Ramah, who said we do it anyway, the Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan said that was only when there's an obligation, a halakhic obligation, put them in nidui, but not in the general situation. And then the Tzitz Eliezer had brought up the idea and the problem and the issue, which Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan didn't even deal with for reasons that are unclear to me, that you also have people who are mumarim lahachis, who are violating the Torah on purpose, knowingly and willfully, or who violate Shabbos in public. And in both those situations, forget the question of whether we shun them or not, or whether we include them in a minyan or not. He said those people, even if we wanted to include them, those people cannot give truma on masrot. It's invalid, it doesn't work. And therefore the mashgichim, the supervisors over fields, have to make sure to be the ones to give it themselves. Then in the other direction, where you have Karaites who don't even affiliate as Jews anymore in the traditional sense of Jews, they are Karaites, they're a whole separate sect of Jews, there, you might have thought, therefore, we could say, well, they're completely not Jewish, there's no need for Truma and Masrot if they've grown a field, their fields don't have a Shemitah issue, but the other Tzitz Eliezer points out that there are those who say that they do count, because if their lineage is Jewish, they count in those ways, and therefore their growing of land in Eretz, of produce in Eretz Israel cannot exempt it from Trumot and Masot. And therefore, we would be required to take Trumot and Masot, and therefore we should not buy from them in Shemitah, unless we think of it as Shemitah product, just in case, but we also wouldn't make a bracha. So those are two examples of how one deals with this very complicated question of when, sadly, Jews have left observance, how we deal with them, both in terms of being aware of the halachic realities, and then also, hopefully, finding ways to bring them closer and not ways to make them go further away. And that is a responsible day, although today it was two, for the 12th of Tammuz, Rav Yisrael Chanan Inspector, and the Tzitzit Eliezer on questions of how to deal with non- and anti-religious Jews. Have a great day.